Welcome to the OnFit Podcast.
Good day and welcome to today's conversation with Carmen Niethammer. We are going to look at the results of OnFit's most recent Gender Balance Index. This is the eighth edition on the performance of gender and diversity in financial institutions. Typically, we look at central banks, sovereign wealth funds, pension funds, and this year we have also included commercial banks for the first time. So we're very pleased to have Carmen here. Carmen is Global Gender Diversity and Inclusion Leader and a Forbes contributor, and she brings a great background and perspective to share her thoughts on this topic and these results. I'm Patricia Haas Cleveland, OnFIV President for U.S. Operations. So welcome, Carmen. We're delighted to have you today. You've been covering gender issues in the financial world for some time. So I want to turn immediately to the headline of this report, which says that after examining more than 500 institutions, this is representing central banks, sovereign wealth funds, pension funds, and commercial banks, how significant is it that today, after decades of prioritizing diversity and inclusion, less than 1% of these institutions have achieved gender balance? What's your take on that?
I mean, should we be surprised or should we not be surprised? I mean, isn't that saying recently, like, I'm shocked but not surprised that we're using these days? I mean, gender diversity and gender leadership, I mean, it's a reflection of our cultures, right? And our upbringing and our institutions. And I think we find a lack of women's leadership, both in the political representation sphere, where I think women around the world only make up 25% in parliaments and among mayors. And we find that same, you know, gap of women leadership and gender diversity also in the private sector, right? But when we look at financial institutions, despite all of these years of trying to get that number higher, it has improved significantly, right, over the last two decades. And thank God we are measuring that, otherwise we wouldn't have maybe necessarily noticed. But of course, there's so much work still to be done. On the other hand, I always feel encouraged because when you look at the different industries globally, financial services and consumer-facing industries are actually the ones where women's leadership is doing much, much better than compared to, for example, heavy industries, right? Or utilities or so we have something to celebrate in the financial industry. And I remember reading some statistics whereby 20 years ago, 40% of those commercial banks studied by Oliver Wyman didn't have any woman on board. And today that's at least in the team. So huge progress, which I think we need to celebrate. On the other hand, the part that I still find extremely shocking, and I'm sure you do too, is that even though we have increased the number of women in leadership, right, and gender diversity overall, but women are still in those really, like, corporate positions, right? So we're finding them in HR, we're finding them in legal, we're finding them in communications. And so that I find still a little bit shocking, and particularly when it comes to also women's leadership in microfinance, where, you know, 80 or 90% of the microfinance clientele are women. Like, how could we not have more women CEOs in microfinance institutions? It makes absolutely no sense. And yeah, I guess what I find encouraging is that at least within the financial sector industries that you have some areas that are doing better. So retail, obviously better than investment banking. But yeah, we have a long, long, long way to go. And why is that? I think at the end of the day, it's still systems, right? It's culture. I don't think it's a lack of not having qualified women, and we can get into that later on how many fabulous women there is actually around the world in those leadership positions. And I also don't think it's a matter of women not wanting to take up these positions. I think it's still systems that need to change, and we need to help institutions more in understanding the business case for diversity as an employer, but also as a service provider, and helping them translate that into action. So I think, yeah, lots of work to be done, still frustrating, and it takes all hands on deck.
Well, Carmen, you've made a lot of really great points here, and I just want to unpack some of them because some of them kind of apply to the sort of the more public sector institutions, central banks, and some of them apply to the commercial sector. Interestingly, their overall scores are not that different. They're all pretty low, certainly lower than I think we agree they should be. So commercial banks are, in fact, do show slightly better record than the public sector. And I want to come back to commercial banks because this year is the first time, as I said, we've included them, and there's some interesting takeaways from that. But if we just go back to the public sector for a second, sort of the central banks, I want to touch on one point you mentioned, and that is kind of the business case. And I think we've seen over and over again that companies that tend to have a more diversified workforce and a more diversified management structure tend to have better results, which in the end of the day is return on ROI. So I think that in part because shareholders, investors, clients, customers, they want to see that kind of result. Maybe that's why the commercial banks are slightly further ahead. You don't have that in the public sector. That could be a factor. I do want to give credit where credit is due in the public sector. We have seen some improvements, and we can tick them off. And obviously, there were some appointments this year that are noteworthy. And interestingly, actually, just to give a shout out, the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond actually did achieve 100% score. So that's great news. We know that the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank has instituted a lot of programs that have been very good. So there have been some improvements. Definitely. We've obviously got Christine Lagarde as a new head of ECB, and we've got, you know, another woman running the IMF. So there's a number of targeted wins, but overall, yes, it's been a pretty dismal performance in the public sector. So if we look at those institutions, is there anything before we turn to the commercial sector you think kind of accounts for this poor track record?
Well, I think still there's a whole thing about role models, right? So I think it's over the years and our like very, very slow progress in terms of gender diversity at the top, I think we are now familiar with those particular women that are leading in financial institutions, like Madame Lagarde is always a name that comes up. And so role modeling is incredibly important. And I just don't think that people have it on the tip of their fingers to actually cite those names of women central bankers around the world, right? Even though within the United States, the Federal Reserve System, that's probably much more the case. And it's probably a huge advantage for the Federal Reserve System, not a surprise that you have such a good ranking for the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, because you have an ecosystem by which role modeling plays a huge role. If you have seen somebody in that particular role who is a woman who can do it, who other women want to aspire to, then you're likely to also increase the pipeline. And that's an incredibly important. And I think just from a systems perspective, being one of many within the Federal Reserve System, you can much easier compare, right? Benchmark. How are we doing in Richmond compared to New York? What's going on? What are you doing? What are we doing? You have the same language, so much easier to actually identify and share best practices. And I think that's a role also that OMFIP with their, you know, now ACE report plays so incredibly well by actually highlighting experiences from around the world. And within Europe, that you could argue it's a membership, the European Union of 27 member states, but it's much more difficult to have that same exchange of information and role modeling. So I think Europe will continue to lag behind the United States because of, you know, the affinity. And so you guys have something amazing going on here in the United States for that. So, but it has to be faster. And I think there again, as you correctly pointed out, it is the business case. And I think central banks just need to embrace much more the business case for being the employer of choice for women too, right? So it is also realizing the business case from diversity, that are innovation, transparency, resilience, that all lead to overall a more stable banking system at the end, that will make the difference also for central banks. Because if you have a more transparent, more fair system that allows women to move to the top, then there's higher employee satisfaction, higher productivity, and that also leads to resilience that is so important, particularly in our times today, right? We have seen that all over the world, that women actually make a huge contribution to being more resilient in their leadership and in their organization for the times that we're facing now. And so, yeah, much more to be done for the central banks, but also much more to learn.
Yes, and I think you raised really probably one of the most critical points, which is the importance of seeing role models. Because if it's already a very heavily dominated industry by men, which it has been traditionally, it's hard to imagine, well, you know, is there a path to the top for me? And you fold in other complicated issues that men haven't had to deal with, which is, you know, having children and juggling that and all those sorts of things. So how does that play out? I think one of the efforts by the St. Louis Fed is to actually showcase role models and to encourage that, because all it takes is, well, they did it, so I can do it. Or there's people at the top, so, you know, I have a pathway there. I'd like to turn to the commercial sector, because as I mentioned, we included this for the first time this year. And I think that there's some very noteworthy takeaways there, too. Obviously, all eyes have been on Citi recently, which is the first Wall Street firm to name a woman head, CEO. So congrats to Citi. If you look below that, you hit a point which I think you already touched on, which I think is very prevalent in many, many banks, and that is the other four women on their executive committee, however, run compliance, administration, audit, HR. So again, you have typically the women are in the non sort of P&L areas, and yet to run a bank as a CEO, you really have to have a P&L background. And I think another important point that we discovered was that if you look at the 50 banks that we looked at, and you look at who are running those P&L divisions, you see that of the top women, that only 18% are running P&Ls. So it's still not a great outcome. JP Morgan probably gets a little bit more credit in this space, because at their sort of top level, out of the 8 senior women at their top level, 5 are running P&Ls. And the importance of this is really, as we know, to develop a talent pool of candidates, because when you're looking for CEOs, they typically come out of sort of that next level down. So that's very important to have a pipeline. And yet it seems like there aren't a lot of pipelines. So we already have pretty bad numbers with Jane Fraser's new appointment, which actually didn't benefit in the survey, which ended in 2020. But looking at that, of the 50 banks, we go from 3 were run by women to 6 as of April being run by women. Still a pretty poor showing to have only 12% of these in the sample pool run by women. So I guess the question is, you know, how is that going to change? And to your point, there was a great quote by a JP Morgan participant who said, and it goes back to what we were talking about role models, a company cannot be seen to be its best if its talented people cannot see themselves in senior leadership position. So it comes back to the whole thing about role models and having women out there so people feel they can, you know, have an opportunity. To your other point about pay, I think it's important to note, because still the pay gaps exist. But again, in our survey, we noted that Citi is now is being accountable and being transparent about its pay and adjusting pay according to gender and other circumstances. So there have been some modest improvements, but there's still the actual numbers of women at the top and the pipeline still look pretty sparse. And I guess the question is, you know, what needs to be done? Is this a cultural issue? I mean, really, 2 decades of talk, is it mostly lip service, or is there something else that needs to happen?
No, I love that in the OMFIF report, you also gave some examples in terms of promoting women's leadership at the top and whether it is grown from inside the organization or whether you just hire from outside, right? So in the case of Citibank and Ms. Fraser, you have, of course, a situation where it's internally hired and internally promoted all the way to the top, which is great. But often that actually doesn't necessarily translate into that result. So it's just, you know, women being hired externally and typically also or not surprisingly, or maybe surprisingly, I don't know how you want to phrase this politically correct, at times of crisis, right? So crisis happens, all men disappear, and then the women are asked to, like, step up, you know, and they do. And then they fix everything, and then they get moved back into the background. The other thing that I also found incredibly interesting in your report, there were some examples of countries and situations where actually women were the deputy and they were in that, you know, echelon just below the top leadership, and they still got overtaken by men. And then you have a public outcry, which I think gets back to this whole consumer client facing perspective, because how is it possible that in 2021 women still cannot be at the top because of some crazy bias, or, you know, when you have a woman on the board or in senior leadership position, that she does not get represented by a woman. And so that is one thing. The second thing is, of course, still the business case. Madame Lagarde in 2019 mentioned that actually just adding a woman to a board associates the organization with an 8 to 13 basis point higher return of the organization. And so, again, for organizations just to embrace that and increase shareholder value is incredibly important. And having organizations like Goldman Sachs make a commitment that they will not take a company public unless they have somebody, a woman on the board, or a person of a diverse background on the board, that's a huge commitment. BlackRock also recently, at the end of 2020, made a commitment to having much more disclosure on their investments on gender diversity on the top. So I think we are at a good moment, but we have to keep the pressure on in terms of civil society, the private sector, investors, consumers, and I think we are going to see a change. That's my sense. And that whole piece of benchmarking, again, I think one can be very arrogant and work in a very prestigious organization and have a diversity program and think everything is going well. But then when you actually go through an exercise like the EDGE Gender Certification and benchmark yourself against other similar organizations, then you realize actually, oh, wait, we are not, we don't do an annual gender pay gap analysis. How is that possible? Or we do it, but kind of voluntarily, or we actually don't do anything to close it. So these things are going to increasingly also exert pressure on organizations. But again, from a business perspective too, I find it surprising that there are so many organizations that don't conduct a gender pay gap, because even if you think that you don't have one, the fact that you cannot demonstrate it and show that you don't have a gender pay gap, in women's minds, they may still think that there is one. So they perceive there to be a gender pay gap, and they will still leave the organization to another organization because they don't feel they have the same opportunities. So I think it's a missed opportunity for some organizations not to fully embrace the whole menu of things. And that said, allow me to be a little bit pessimistic, because I'm typically a very optimistic person. The part that makes me pessimistic is that a lot of these leading organizations have done everything that they could, but it's low-hanging fruits. So now we are actually getting into the phase of having to tackle the more difficult topics, right? So diversity is one thing, counting that you have diverse backgrounds, diverse genders, diverse educational backgrounds, race, religion, whatever, nationalities, all of this can play in. But the inclusion part is much, much more difficult to tackle. And so how do we actually make real progress? So it's not just counting the beans, but actually making sure that we have a stew where every ingredient matters, right? And so that will be interesting to see how organizations in the next phase make a huge difference and where they lead.
Well, you know, again, you've said a lot of very interesting things there. And I'm particularly want to come back, to your comment about Goldman Sachs, because I don't think Goldman Sachs does anything as a very successful financial firm unless it makes financial sense. And I think that a lot of companies realize that they want to be top performers. And if they want to be top performers, they need to figure out how to attract, retain, and promote the best pools of talent. Mm-hmm. And that is not restricted to one sort of stereotype. It is indeed very diverse. And also, I think they're realizing that there are a lot of women coming into the workforce. And if women don't see a pathway to the top, they're just going to walk with their feet and, or not walk with their feet, but vote with their feet and go elsewhere. And so if you really want to get the best talent, you need to have your doors open to them, and they have to really see that this does make sense. So I do think this business case is increasingly going to be adopted. So these companies are not doing these moves for altruistic reasons. They definitely, you know, want to be successful. They also see, you know, that their shareholders, again, their clients or customers, that they expect this, and that this is typically does lead, the best performing companies do tend to get, you know, good results for this. I also want to come back to another point you mentioned about, is this sort of cultural? And again, I come back to the fact that this has been going on for two decades. And at the beginning, all the programs were rolled out. It was like, oh, women need help. We need to give them training. They need to learn about leadership. They need to learn how to speak up. All this sort of stuff was oriented towards women and these diversity programs. And listen, that's fine. At a time when there, you know, weren't many women, there weren't many role models, programs like this is good. But at the end of the day, you really have to step back and say, you know, there are a lot of talented women out there, but let's look at the real world. Who determines their pay? Who determines the hiring? Who determines the promotion opportunities? It's their managers. And do the managers really buy into that? Or is it just easier to kind of go with the flow with what they know from the past? So I think this question about, is there a cultural issue? And I think if you don't tackle the cultural issue, managers have to be accountable too. Managers who make the pay decisions, make the promotion decisions, make the hiring decisions, they also need to be accountable. And that starts at the top. So it's not just enough to say, gee, we've spent all this money, we have all these great programs, we hired a diversity leader, that's all easy to do, that's lip service. But if your numbers, after all this time, shows these kind of results, maybe a different tack needs to be taken. So, I don't know, maybe there's something to be said for the cultural angle. I don't know if you think that's the case too.
No, and I think especially male CEOs on the top, or any men in top leadership positions, they have to embrace it, if for nothing else, for the better business performance of their organization. And if they don't, it will actually backfire, right? Because even like one little comment, oh my God, I just have to do this gender diversity stuff again. If they just say it like on the side in one meeting, despite the best policies they put in place, the entire efforts will crumble. So it has to be a priority, not priority number seven, but among the top three priorities of an organization to actually want to make that change happen. And I listened to this amazing podcast between Madame Lagarde and Ursula von der Leyen, the head of the European Union. They talked about their whole experience in women in leadership, in particular in the financial sector as well. And it's hilarious, actually, because, you know, women have been forced over time to always outperform and prepare better in order to be recognized by men, or to actually make the point that they are also very good. But in the long run, they have really outperformed. They are so much better that I think it's also now at that moment where we actually see that, you know what, they have prepared for 20 years. So don't you tell a woman anymore that she needs to have some, you know, training in order to get there, because just the way that the system was stacked against them, they have continuously needed to prepare better, and that will pay off in the long run. I'm convinced.
Yes. Well, I think that's a great point. And I think if we go back to basically the business case, it is the companies that are realizing, you know, this is in our business interest to get this right. This is not just some side distraction where we kind of have to be seen to be, you know, good civic citizens. This is all about delivering the best results. So let's hope that we continue to see improvements. Let's hope that next year's gender balance index shows better results, that we get over the under 1% number, and that companies realize, as well as official institutions, that more can be done and that everybody will benefit from this. So,
and the one thing that, if you allow me to just also make that strong, the point very, very strong, specifically for commercial banks, but also for, I think, central banks, we do have a very clear correlation between gender diversity and the ability of an organization to reach the women's market, right? So those organizations that really want to profitably benefit from the women's market, because there's a huge finance gap across different financial products in the world, those organizations that are able to capture the women's market best and include them in their clientele base, they also have higher numbers of diversity within the organization. And I am convinced, and I would love OMFIF to do more analysis on that as well going forward, maybe not next year, but maybe in the next 5 years when we have a little bit more of a base to database to analyze it on, to see whether central banks that exhibit higher gender diversity, both at the top but also within the organization, whether they actually also further the financial inclusion of women in their respective countries. Because I would be surprised that if you had a substantial amount of women and a different perspective in the work of a central bank, that that wouldn't automatically also have a positive impact on the final consumer, so to speak, of the regulatory system, i.e. women citizens, and to make sure that the financial inclusion gap actually on gender shortens, right? Be it because we now have the data, gender segregated data on women, on account holders, on savings, on credits, that we have regulatory reforms that allow for different collaterals, that we actually have further digital financing, that we have promoted mobile banking, closed the mobile banking gap, and have, you know, enhanced electronic payments for employees. All of these things, I think, are likely to be in place in countries where the gender diversity in central banks is also there. And I think there's a huge, huge case to be made there. And I can't wait for that data to come out in like a few years from now where we can actually show, we knew it all along. There was a huge business case also for the central banks.
Carmen, that is really a great point. And I will pass that along, that we need to look at this, but I do think that's a fabulous point about the public sector. I think it's a great corollary to the private sector, because you just reiterated the fact that, given the sort of the pressure from clients to do better, to tap into the U.S. female market alone is an incentive for the commercial banks to do better. And that's why perhaps they are indeed taking the lead. At the end of the day, it all comes down to you end up with better results, whether it's in the commercial financial institutions or in the public sector. Carmen, this has been great. Thank you so much for your perspective.
We're not going to fix the world right now and here, but we made hopefully a little bit of a contribution to having some people who are listening today actually take action and look at their own data sets. So that'd be wonderful.
Absolutely. Thank you again very much.
I appreciate the conversation. Thanks so much to OMFIF for their excellent work. Take care, Patricia.
Thank you. Same to you. Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the OMFIF podcast.